welcome to a special Jazz Crossroads of America edition of Nightlights. I'm David Brent Johnson. In 20th century segregated America, major cities often had a main stem where black businesses and entertainment venues were situated. In Indianapolis, that main stem and the areas around it gave rise to the careers of J.J. Johnson, Freddie Hubbard, Wes Montgomery, Slide Hampton, David Baker, and numerous other talented jazz artists. It's Indiana Avenue, Black Boulevard of Jazz, coming up next on Nightlights. West Montgomery Trio, with Montgomery on guitar, Melvin Ryan on organ, and Paul Parker on drums, doing Thelonious Monk's Round Midnight. 20th century segregated America, big cities often had a main stem where black businesses and entertainment venues clustered along a street that ran through the heart of the African American community. In Indianapolis, the crossroads capital of a vital Midwestern state, that street was Indiana Avenue, a place that became a destination in the early 1900s for blacks during the Great Migration from the South. In following decades, the neighborhood would rise and fall, reflecting the racial, cultural, and economic changes of the times. And its music scene would produce some of the world's most significant jazz artists. Indiana Avenue historian David Williams grew up in the neighborhood.
Many of the people around town, they would put on their finest to come on the avenue because of racism. This was our world. We couldn't go down Meridian Street or downtown to perform or to be entertained, so we had to come on the avenue. So we made the best of it.
Like many other young African Americans, David Baker, who would go on to become a world-renowned jazz performer and educator, explored the avenue with his friends.
You know, we were too young to get into clubs to begin with. And so when Slide and David Young and the rest of us would go to clubs, we would try to bluff our way in first by wearing the beret and the glasses with no glass in them. And eyebrow pencils would draw mustaches. And sometimes it would work. Sometimes we would get in. Sometimes we couldn't get in, you know. But it was a cornucopia of musical events.
Bassist and jazz educator Larry Ridley also grew up in the Indiana Avenue neighborhood and remembers the avenue at its height of activity.
People in the streets, attending different places. You know, there were all kinds of places like chicken rib joints and, you know, you name it. I mean, it was a very live, you know, kind of thing, just like it was in Harlem. The same kind of thing or other cities where there were these black neighborhoods. You know, that was where people who had been working all week or whatever, they came out. And then even during the week, people would come out. You know, they'd stop by and have a beer or whatever, hang out.
One of the most prominent jazz musicians to emerge from this mid-20th century Indiana Avenue scene was trombonist J.J. Johnson. Johnson left Indianapolis at an early age and became a fixture on New York City's revolutionary 1940s bebop scene. Trombonist and Indiana University jazz educator Brent Wallerab on Johnson's importance as a player.
J.J. Johnson took the trombone to new technical levels. His ability to play at those fast bebop tempos, nobody had been able to do. And up to J.J., thought it was impossible to do on trombone. In fact, there was a debate when his first records came out. They thought he had to be playing valve trombone, not a slide trombone, because it's much easier to play fast on a valve instrument like a trumpet or flugelhorn than it is on a slide trombone. So he set the bar really high for jazz trombone with speed, technique, that kind of virtuosity, harmonic understanding, and just set a whole new stage for what was expected with jazz trombone players.
J.J. Johnson's virtuosic soloing on Riffette, recorded in 1947. Johnson would also prove over the course of his long career to be a highly skilled and sophisticated composer and arranger, and he would make many dynamic recordings both in small group and larger ensemble formats. Here's an early composition waxed with trumpeter Clifford Brown, Turnpike. Thank you. J.J. Johnson and Turnpike, recorded for Blue Note in 1953. Johnson would spend a number of years in New York City and then in Hollywood, scoring films and television shows before returning to Indianapolis in the late 1980s and remaining there for the rest of his life. He told an interviewer he'd come back because it's home. Let's take a walk along the main stem of Johnson's hometown now, Indiana Avenue in its heyday, with historian David Williams and jazz educator David Baker.
Walking down the avenue, I would start at Indian Avenue. I'd walk past the Lockfield Drugstore, then the Bridgeforce Fish Market, Mr. George Stratton's funeral home. Across the street from that would be Ed's liquor store, the barbecue, Forrest Jones's Barbecue Heaven, and then I would pass the MacArthur Conservatory of Music, and you'd hear music kind of booming out of all the different clubs, George's Bar, the PNP Club, the 440 Club, the Place to Play. And there was it'll be different classes of people coming out of the different clubs. Like, for example, if out of the Panama Club, let's say the Panama Club, the Downbeat, you'd have people there who, you know, you'd have to worry about them. That'd be called the blood bucket. And you'll see people who would be comfortable in a blood bucket, a bucket of blood nightclub. But if you go further up and you would see, go past Al Cohen's British Lounge at George's Bar, you see teachers, doctors, lawyers, business people.
David Baker remembers renowned artists such as Charlie Parker appearing at clubs like the Sunset Terrace.
And we would stand out in the back where we could hear him from behind. And listen, and I can remember Coltrane playing alto in Dizzy Gillespie's big band, you know, there. And we would have all the after-hour clubs. This is still the time of Blue Laws, you know. And these were changing. Probably one of the earliest was the Sky Club. And the Sky Club was a place where they had, you know, tap dancers. I remember Flash and Flash there. They had comedians, female impersonators, jazz groups, and you could go up there and jam after you got off, you know, after you got off from your regular job. But this was a beehive of activity, man. When you walk down Indiana Avenue, so we're talking about probably 15 blocks. And in those 15 blocks, all the history of Indiana Avenue was made. I mean, you know, there were probably 15, 20 clubs that had jazz six nights a week. And so you heard Jimmy Cole, you heard Wes Montgomery, you heard Sly at Hampton later on. Also, all of these people were musicians that you would hear, and all of them in their formative stages. But at the same time, we had all the visiting players, and everybody thought when Dexter Gordon came to town, or Charlie Parker, or Gene Ammons, that we were going to field our own team.
The after-hours joints that Baker mentions were celebrated in a hit 1953 recording by Indianapolis saxophonist Jimmy Coe. Coe had already begun to make a name for himself in the 1940s, playing baritone sax with Jay McShann's band and replacing a young Charlie Parker on alto when Parker and McShann parted ways. And from the 1950s on, Coe was a mainstay on the Indianapolis scene.
There was almost an after-hour joint in every block. Clubs closed at 12. So yeah. We worked
couple of jobs. It started 8 to 12, and then from 1 to about 3 or 4.
Coe took his song After Hours joint to King Records in Cincinnati first.
I said, you guys be interested in something like After Hours joint? They listened to it and said, no, no. So I went to Chicago to state. And the cat listened to it. He said, play it again. I said, okay. Play it again. He said, when can you come record? 2 weeks later, we recorded. And about a month later, it sold, I don't know how many copies. There are crooks up there. Chicago's full of crooks.
Say, baby, don't put too much ice in, man. See, I'm trying to socialize and have a good time. A little short, too. Say, Foxy Shooters got straight downtown. Oh, man, him and the chief is just like that.
Saxophonist Jimmy Coe performing his 1953 hit After Hours joint. Coe's longtime friend and sometime musical partner Pookie Johnson was a key member of the Montgomery Johnson Quintet, a group which gigged frequently around Indianapolis in the mid-1950s. This group featured three brothers: Monk Montgomery on Fender bass, which he helped to pioneer in jazz, Buddy Montgomery on piano, and Wes Montgomery on guitar. Here's the Montgomery Johnson Quintet on a little-known demo recorded for Columbia Records in 1955, performing fellow Indiana native Cole Porter's Love for Sale. We'll be right back. Pianist Buddy Montgomery, bassist Monk Montgomery, guitarist Wes Montgomery, tenor saxophonist Pookie Johnson, and drummer Sonny Johnson doing Cole Porter's Love for Sale at a Columbia Records demo session in 1955. The session did not pan out for the Indianapolis musicians, who worked day jobs to support their families and played their music at night. Wes Montgomery was one such musician, but his fortunes took a turn in 1959 while he was playing an after-hours club on Indiana Avenue called the Missile Room. Indiana jazz historian Duncan Sheet was there the night that members of a touring jazz all-star group came by to see the local legend.
In the door come two blind men, George Shearing and Lenny Tristano, on someone's arm. They were both brought in together. And I had seen them at the theater, and I thought, wow, this is great. And so they sat in a dark corner in the gloom over there, and after a while, Cannonball Adderley came in, and he sat down with them, and they were chatting away. Wes was still working away, and Melvin Ryan, his organist, finally showed up, and Wes said to him, do you know who's over there? And Melvin said, no, I don't know. He looked around. He couldn't see anybody. He says, Lenny Tristano, George Shearing, and Cannonball Adderley, and I think that Mel blanched at the moment. I would have. Anyhow, it was terrific. And so a little later on, they began to set up and play. And within a half of chorus, I think, Cannonball had dragged his chair out to a spot right in front of Wes, in front of the stage. And he was sitting sideways to me. And I was away from the stage, but was looking directly in on it. And well, you could say that Cannonball was knocked out. He just actually leaned back in his chair, mouth hanging open, and he was just listening. And Wes's guitar was just taking him out of this world. Thank you.
The West Montgomery Trio performing Missile Blues. Montgomery became renowned for his singular approach that built his solos from single notes to octaves, and also for using his thumb instead of a pick.
This technique, which is unschooled, mm-hmm. and it's pure West Montgomery, this technique and what you do with it, playing octaves in your solo lines, this is what has set you apart from every other guitarist in life. And as I remember the story you telling me many years ago, this came about because, first of all, playing with your thumb rather than a pick was quieter.
Yeah. Well, it didn't, a pick seems to have more of a piercing sound, and it's sharper. Mm-hmm. And, well, when I first started, I started with a pick, of course, everybody else was starting with a pick. And I used to use, I liked it for my amplifier to be on, because I found out that when you practice without an amplifier for like 2 months, and then you use the amplifier, you hear more noise than you do notes.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, I'll break that habit, so I just use the amplifier all the time. But while doing that, I would go into the night practicing, and but I forgot I was disturbing neighbors.
Yeah.
So that was very shortly it brought to my attention.
Wes Montgomery was a self-taught musician, but many of the Indiana Avenue jazz musicians, such as Larry Ridley, benefited from more formal instruction, such as the Ruth MacArthur Conservatory.
Miss MacArthur's conservatory was really like a well, if I can use that expression, to which we all drank out of, that sent a lot of people on a variety of different ways to become successful.
Then there was the all-black high school Crispus Attucks, built in the 1920s because of segregation, but turned into a point of pride by its students and faculty.
The professors in the Attucks music department could only teach at Attucks because of racism, so many of them had been music professors at universities and colleges. So you had essentially college professors teaching high school kids, and they got we got the best of the best.
Black history was part of the curriculum. And that's an idea that would not become, you know, popular or even doable until the Civil Rights Movement.
They were very nurturing, and they took an interest in us. And, you know, they were like parents. And they really wanted to see us succeed. And that was the beautiful thing about us. And, you know, they were always very nurturing, as well as being sticklers to make sure that we weren't, you know, goofing off or anything like that. So that was something, you know, so it was a community.
There was also a legendary Indiana Avenue figure who never recorded, but who mentored many of the players on the scene.
If there was a Indiana Avenue University of Jazz, then Lucas Earl Groundhog Grandy would have been the president, the head of the music department, the dean of performance. He was the second coming to people on Indian Avenue. All the jazz people talked about him. He taught so much to so many people who later on became world renowned. Wes Montgomery, J.J. Johnson, Leroy Vinegar, Carl Perkins, Jimmy Cole, Mingo Jones, Al Coleman. He taught them all.
He's the godfather of music in Indianapolis. Anything he could reproduce anything he heard. You could drop a nickel on the floor and tell you what note it is. And what was so amazing about it, he said, that's B flat, but it's a little bit on the sharp side.
I'll have more music from the golden age of Indianapolis jazz in just a few moments. The Nightlight series Jazz Crossroads of America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, bringing the arts to all Americans. Production support for Nightlights also comes from Landlocked Music CDs and Vinyl, located at 202 North Walnut in Bloomington or online at landlockedmusic.com, and from the Laughing Planet Cafe and Soma Coffee House on the corner of Kirkwood and Grant in Bloomington, Indiana. You can listen to this and other Nightlights programs and view playlists on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. I'm David Brent Johnson, and you're listening to Indiana Avenue, Black Boulevard of Jazz, a special Jazz Crossroads of America edition of Nightlights. ¶¶ In the world of Indianapolis's Indiana Avenue music scene, two families loomed large, the Montgomerys and the Hamptons. The Hampton family, with 12 children who all learned to play instruments under the tutelage of their father, Duke, would produce several musicians of note, including Elytra and Virtue Hampton, and most famously, trombonist Slide Hampton. Brent Wallerab puts Hampton in a holy trinity of Indianapolis jazz trombonists.
Like David Baker, he took what J.J. Johnson established in the 40s and 50s and took it to the next level as far as virtuosity and as far as harmonic complexity. And Slide Hampton has continued to play trombone and just astound people with the trombone. There are a lot of incredibly technical trombone players on the jazz scene today. You can't believe how fast they play. You can't believe how high they play. Okay. It's dazzling, amazing technique, but ultimately, frankly, a lot of that stuff leaves a lot to be desired because there's not a lot of substance beyond that technique. You get someone like Slide Hampton who has all that technique and all that range, and behind it, there's the blues, there's swing, there's melody, there's this soulfulness, there's this deep, resonant tone quality that has so much nuance to it. But he's one of the few trombone players who has it all.
Trombonist Slide Hampton and his composition Go East, Young Man, recorded in 1959, a place where some of Indianapolis's most talented musicians, such as bassist Larry Ridley, did indeed eventually go.
Well, because, you know, in order to, I guess, I don't want to sound, you know, slick or hip by saying this, but, you know, we knew that in order to make it in this music, because we wanted to do it as a full-time vocation, and avocation, you know, and in order to make a living and to be employed as a musician, you basically had to leave. I mean, we could have stayed and maybe worked, you know, at some of the clubs that were there, but things were changing.
There are very few live recordings of artists from Indianapolis's golden age of jazz, but Larry Ridley and some of his fellow East Coast-bound Hoosier musicians can be heard on one that provides us with a unique connection to the living world of late 1950s Indiana Avenue hard bop.
Paul Parker on drums, Bernie Hubbard on trumpet, Jimmy Spaulding on alto, tenor and flute, and yours truly Larry Ridley on bass, comprising the jazz contemporaries.
Ridley on how the gig and recording came about.
My uncle Tom Ridley and Martin Ridley, they knew the owner of George's Bar. And so my uncle said, oh man, you guys really sound good. And I was saying to them, you think you could get us a gig? And so they were the ones that talked the guy into hiring us. And that turned out to be fantastic. And fortunately, there was a guy, a couple of guys that were students at IU that came up and recorded that.
Do a number that was recorded by Miles Davis and his great group. Sang by very famous jazz arranger on the modern scene today, Ted Darner. Sang entitled Ted's Delight.
Club owner was happy because we had all of some of the finest ladies in town showing up, and we were playing six nights and two matinees, and all the guys would come in because they knew all the pretty chicks in town were going to be on the scene. So it was like, and the club owner was making money, so we stayed there. I forget how long we stayed there. It was, oh man, we must have been there at least 2 or 3 months during the summer month.
Contemporaries with the teenage Freddie Hubbard, Larry Ridley, and saxophonist James Spalding performing Tad's Delight at George's on Indiana Avenue in the summer of 1957. All three musicians would soon leave the city. Spalding would put in some time with the legendary Sun Ra, and they would all appear on the prestigious Blue Note label in the 1960s, sometimes together. Here's one such recording, Freddie Hubbard's Kunga Black. Thank you. Trumpeter Freddie Hubbard performing Kunga Black with fellow Indianapolis musicians James Spalding on flute and Larry Ridley on bass. Another Indianapolis musician who went to New York was trombonist David Baker, whose hard bop group was absorbed by pianist and jazz theorist George Russell. Working under his direction, the band, featuring tenor saxophonist David Young, trumpeter Al Kiger, and drummer Joe Hunt, made some of the early 1960s most progressive jazz records and provided a showcase for Baker's trombone prowess.
And George rehearsed us every day, and we were already playing every night, and he turned it into the George Russell Sextet. And when we became the George Russell Sextet, George then took us to New York. We opened at the Five Spot, and on any given night, man, you'd look over there, and there would be Miles and J.J. and Coltrane and Sonny Rollins. Not necessarily even though they were curious about us, but because it was George Russell's group. And so they would come and hear us every night, and I can see this vision now of Train always standing against the wall, with one foot up against the wall, leaning against the wall, eating sun-kissed raisins. And it was really very, very beautiful.
David took the trombone to yet another level, technically. When you listen to David Baker's trombone playing on those great George Russell things from the early 60s, you hear a trombone technique that was at the top. I don't think anybody was playing that accurately, that fast, yet. Since then, a lot of people have done it and can do it. Slide was even, you know, was even a couple years from being that fast and that accurate as David Baker. Plus, David Baker was exploring new things harmonically that hadn't really been touched on yet by any trombone player, and a lot of other jazz players just trying to, you can hear a real striving to grasp every and all different kind of harmonic implication and harmonic substitution. And he was the most advanced trombone player of his era at that point too. And dealing with time concepts, his famous solo on Kentucky Oysters where the whole band is playing in a fast three and he's playing in a slow four, and has worked out the subdivisions very ahead of its time and shows incredible control on the trombone. So yeah, he was hugely influential. Thank you.
David Baker's Indianapolis group, under the leadership of George Russell, performing Baker's Kentucky Oysters with Baker on trombone, David Young on tenor sax, and Al Kiger on trumpet. By the 1960s, Indiana Avenue was in decline. Indiana Avenue historian David Williams on the reasons why.
This was our whole world. So when integration came to be, then a lot of the patrons of the Avenue opted for a new experience, a new social experience. They would leave the Avenue, the Sunset, and go to the Embers on Meridian Street. So along with the leaving the Avenue, that their funds left the Avenue. So the Avenue was milk dry. Another factor would be the federal highway system that came through town and really destroyed the West Side community and allowed the churches and structure, the houses were cleared away for the highway. So many of the patrons who would come to the Avenue had to move, they had moved to different parts of town, and because of the distance factor, many of them stopped frequenting the Avenue. And the third, one of the most impacting factors would be the expansion of IUPUI.
The development of IUPUI, the joint Indiana-Purdue College campus, may have been the final blow for a neighborhood that could not survive the urban changes of the 1960s and 70s. Hardly any of Indiana Avenue's original buildings survive today, save for the Madam Walker Theater. But the Avenue's musical heritage has been increasingly acknowledged, celebrated, and remembered in recent times. Pookie Johnson and Jimmy Coe were interviewed for this program, but have since passed on, like so many other musicians from the Avenue. We still have their words, as well as their music, to bring to life the lost world of another time, when a community brought together by racial oppression found a way to persevere, overcome, and work to build a prosperity of the heart.
I'll tell you one thing. Mondays and Saturdays was hell. You have Monday matinee,
yeah,
and Saturday, Monday night, and Saturday matinee, and Saturday night.
Yeah.
And sometimes after hours. So.
When you guys sleep?
That was a problem.
Them was the good old days. Didn't make much money, but they had a lot of fun.
Blue Monday.
J.J. Johnson performing his composition Naptown USA, based on the changes of Back Home Again in Indiana. Thanks for tuning in to this special Jazz Crossroads of America edition of Nightlights, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, bringing the arts to all Americans. Production support for Nightlights also comes from Landlocked Music CDs and vinyl, and from the Laughing Planet Cafe and Soma Coffee House. You can listen to this and other Nightlights programs on our website at indianapublicmedia.org/nightlights. Special thanks to David and Lida Baker, Larry Ridley, David Williams, and Nightlights production and research assistant John Porter. I'm David Brent Johnson, wishing you good listening for the week ahead.